We're going to spend a little bit of time on miracles this morning. So I wanted to read just a letter or two out of children's letters to God. Hard to select some here. Dear God, last week it rained 3 days. We thought it would be like Noah's Ark, but it wasn't. I'm glad because you could only take two of things, remember? And we have three cats. Dear God, are you real? Some people don't not believe it. If you are, you better do something quick. Dear God, when you wrote the Bible, you made up all the words and spelled them any way you like. That is great. Most of the time I do like that, but I am not doing so good. Oh, well, now here's one. Dear God, your book has lots of zip to it. I like science fiction stories. You had very good ideas, and I would like to know where you found them. Oh, dear God, we are learning about Jonah and the whale, where he was swallowed him and everything. It's the best story I ever heard, with action and fright. My daddy says it sounds fishy. Do you think that's funny? Dear God, how do you feel about people who don't believe in you? Somebody else wants to know. Dear God, this is a good one. Dear God, are boys better than girls? I know you are one, but try to be fair. Well, all right. The Gospel of Mark. If you don't have an outline, there are some right back where Judy Grossfeld is standing. In fact, if she will just turn the other way, she will see some outlines. Who else needs any? Okay. I've got lots of them, but I didn't bring them all down. As you will notice, the Gospel of Mark has a structure to it which indicates the careful crafting that Mark did as he put his Gospel together. It's not a haphazard collection of stories. It is a series of stories arranged in which the arrangement itself is a part of the message, is a part of the way Mark is communicating what he has to say. The whole of the gospel is about Jesus and his disciples, about the way Jesus is the Messiah and the way the community that he calls into being shares in his messianic way of being in the world. So, the first part of the gospel has to do with the gathering of disciples. We talked on Tuesday about the calling of the disciples. Yesterday, that formal act of appointing the 12, and today, sending the disciples, beginning with Mark's characteristic summary section. Mark 6, the second half, Mark 6:6, the second half of that verse. He went about among the villages teaching. See, we had just had chapter 4 in which Mark introduces Jesus' characteristic way of teaching, namely the parable. And now Mark summarizes all of this just in a single sentence. He went about the villages teaching, the second half of Mark 6:6. Now comes the new thing with regard to the disciples. He called to him the 12 and began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. One of Herb Brokering's sayings that I've not read anywhere but often quoted is, it takes two to be Jesus. That is, if he is going to send out people, he will send out a community, I've often wondered how Herb figured this out and what he means, it takes two to be Jesus. But I guess the point is that if we are going to represent the event of Jesus in the world, it has to be through confessing and forgiving, and it takes two for that. It has to be through parabling. And one of the things that Dominic Crossan says is, you can never tell yourself a parable any more than you can play yourself at chess or tell yourself a joke, partly because a parable encounters you. It's a word event that comes to you from outside of yourself and alters your expectation, you see. If you're expecting one thing, the parable challenges you, challenges your expectations. Judy was reading about this morning from Michael Novak, the shattering of us. So when Jesus wants to be represented in the world, it is by the way two people interact with each other, how they tell parables to each other, how they shatter each other, how they confront each other, how they admonish and forgive each other. That's the way the event of Jesus is really represented in the world. So I think it makes sense to send them out at least two by two. Jesus said it, wherever two or three are gathered in my name, you know, there am I in the midst of them. He's present in that way. He charged them to take nothing for their journey except the staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not to even put on two tunics. And he said to them, where you enter a house, stay there until you leave the place. And if any place will not receive you and they refuse to hear you, when you leave, shake off the dust that is on your feet for a testimony against them. Somebody has called this the sacrament of non-communion. You aren't going to have anything in common, not even the dust of the village. Okay. So they went out and preached that men should repent, and they cast out many demons. The repent here, by the way, is the shuv, the Old Testament shuv. Turn around. You're going in one direction. Turn around and go in the other direction. They went out, cast out demons, anointed with oil many that were sick, and healed them. I want to stop here for a moment and just say something about the miracles. I think this might be a good place. We concluded yesterday's section. I was going to say last week's section. I am really in a fog this morning. We concluded yesterday's section with that whole collection of miracles, and there will be some more today. So let me just take out a moment to say something. The New Testament reports 37 acts of Jesus that we would call miracles. 19 of them are reported in Mark, 21 in Matthew, 22 in Luke. And now comes a really kind of astonishing note. Only 8 of them are reported in John. The curious thing is that in John's gospel, Jesus is presented to us as in his most transcendent appearance. John starts out already, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and tented among us. So he leaves you in no doubt as to who is the principal actor. But he has the least miracles reported. Very interesting. Now, we have difficulty, I think, with miracles today, or at least I do. Perhaps some of you don't, but I do. And the difficulties are usually of two kinds. On the one hand, for many people, it seems as if the miracles didn't happen. With our understanding of the word, of the world, with our understanding of the world, it's very difficult for us to contemplate the nature miracles, the healings, and so on. On the other hand, we also have difficulties with them if they did seem to have happened. Because then we want to ask, why didn't Jesus heal everybody? And why did the people he healed get sick later on and die? And why, if Jesus did all those kinds of things then, doesn't he do them today? So in a sense, we have difficulties with these stories. Either way, let me just try to comment in three sentences to these concerns. First of all, I think we have to say, because of the almost unanimous testimony of these documents, that Jesus did most of the things that were reported in the Gospels. I think this is a kind of astonishing turnaround from perhaps 100 years ago in New Testament study, when many scholars tried to sort of explain away the things that happened, or avoid them and ignore them. When Thomas Jefferson put his gospel together, he carefully snipped out all of the miracles and had only teachings of Jesus, so that in Jefferson's view, Jesus ends up as a kind of wisdom teacher. But I think today we would have to say Jesus really did do most of the things reported in the Gospels, if not in the same way that they are reported. We aren't always sure of that, but at least roughly corresponding to the way they are reported. I can think of only about two things that I don't think Jesus did. One was, we're going to come to one of them, and that is the cursing of the fig tree. And the other one is the coin in the fish's mouth story. Both of those stories seem to be somewhat like the apocryphal gospel stories that didn't make it into the New Testament. You know, the stories in which Jesus is playing with clay and he makes birds and out of clay and then blows on them and they fly away. He just does these kinds of things almost as a magician. The coin in the fish's mouth is like that magical story. But I think that most of the things that Jesus are reported to have done, he did. The second thing I think we need to say is that the ancient worldview understood these things as miracles. That was simply part of their outlook on life. But the interesting thing is that they ascribed these miracles to many people and to many places. There were healing places like the pool of Siloam, where people went to be healed when the waters were troubled, or other places in the ancient world that seemed to have specially healing powers. Jesus' disciples now, and this is the main thing, Jesus' disciples did many of the same kinds of things that Jesus did. So that leads us then to the third conclusion. The stories about what Jesus did are never proofs. That isn't, you know, you don't say, well, he is the Messiah because he did these things. And he never uses them as proofs either. They are variously interpreted. They are set in various contexts. And yesterday we saw that there were many people who said, well, he's doing these things as a regent or an agent of Satan, not as an agent of God. So the miracles, in a sense, the deeds settle nothing. They don't tell us anything. They don't give us the final clinching answer, is this or is this not the way to go? He does not say, I am the Son of God and therefore I can do miracles. And at the climax to the gospel, when they are standing at the foot of the cross and taunting him, if you are the Son of God, pull one off, you know. Come down from there that we may see and believe. The crazy thing is that Jesus is never more the Son of God than in that moment when he is most helpless, most powerless, most ridiculed, most despised. That is the crashing paradox that Mark is trying to confront us with. Nevertheless, the signs are sort of, in a sense, the come on. C.S. Lewis has a marvelous insight somewhere where he says, we should not draw too many hasty conclusions about our penetration into the kingdom of God by the number of miracles that we have experienced in our lives. He says, that's sort of the vestibule of being a part of the kingdom. The deeper into it that we go, the closer we come to its heart and its center, he says, the lonelier and more desperate are the outposts to which we are sent. And the one who was closest of all to God was sent to the loneliest place of all. So I think those are some helpful things for us to note. And Mark makes this point now in a glaring combination, just one of those daring juxtapositions of his. Right after he tells the story of the sending of the disciples, look what comes. Mark combines that sending story with the beheading of John the Baptist. Because you have all this dynamis, all this power, because you are able to cast out demons and anoint with oil those who are sick and heal them, don't draw hasty conclusions. To be sent out with power does not protect us from the ravages of evil in the world. It may shield us from the despair over evil, but not from evil itself. For there was none greater in the kingdom than John the Baptist, and how does he lose his head? In a crazy, drunken orgy in Herod's palace where a tyrant who can get away with this kind of thing can have his head without due process simply because he is caught up in Salome's dance. This is a great story. We know some of these names like Salome and the beheading from Josephus as well as from the New Testament. And Richard Strauss has put together this gorgeous opera in which actually Salome falls in love with Yohanan, this strong prophet, and wants him as a kind of ornament on her good luck bracelet. But Yohanan refuses Salome, and so in her fit of pique at his refusal, she then asks for his head. Well, nothing like that. I think it's probably much more tawdry even than Richard Strauss's reconstruction of this. And it's Yohanan is here, John the Baptist is here, the victim of that kind of absurd evil that we saw so much of in the Holocaust television series this spring, you know, where people who had the power could simply use it arbitrarily to slaughter millions of people. That kind of evil is now what's going on here in the John the Baptist narrative. And notice how Mark just jams these together. John is already dead, you see, when the sending occurs, and he has to backtrack. King Herod heard of Jesus, and had whose name had become known. And some said, John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead. That's why these powers are at work in him. But others said Elijah, and so on. And then Herod says, I think it's John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. And now Mark tells this story. You see, it had already happened before the incident. Why does he put it in here? It's almost a way of saying loudly to us, don't draw conclusions from the successes that you have. Evil is still around, and the way the witness is going to be born in the face of evil does not mean that it will be eliminated, but that there will be alternative ways to experience it, redemptively or destructively, in despair or in faith. That is the word that is being laid on us. All right, let me go on to the conflict with the Pharisees. I'm going to save the feeding story because I want to come to that at the end. I'm going to put the two feeding stories together. One of them is here in 6 and the other one in 8. In chapter 7, The first, that should be changed on your outlines from Mark 7, 1 to 12. It should be Mark 7, 1 to 23, the conflict with the Pharisees. Again, we need some history in order to be able to see what's going on here. First of all, it looks as if it's an argument over good manners. The Pharisees in chapter 7 are all upset because some of his disciples ate with hands defiled, that is, unwashed. Happens at our house a lot. We our children come with defiled hands to the table and have to be sent to get them washed. Well, but this is not about manners at all. We have to go back into the ancient world and to understand something about the whole notion of what is clean and unclean. And that takes us into the notion of contact with the deity. I'm not talking now about disease, the lepers who had to say unclean, unclean, but the many ways in which if you came into contact with something that was regarded as divine, as participating in the divine, is if you touched it, then you couldn't, you were sacral, you see, you became sacred in that moment, and therefore you couldn't touch other things. And there were all kinds of gradations of this. For example, you could not touch a woman after birth. Birth was one of the great sacral mysteries, you see. Or if you touched a corpse after it was dead, death, another one of these sacral mysteries, then you were unclean for 30 days or 40 days, you see. You could not have normal contact with other people. That's what this unclean business means. Because you had touched something which was close to the sacred, you see. Now, Jesus' whole point in the conflict with the Pharisees has to do with what really constitutes sacredness. Is it contact with external objects, with the experience of birth, with the experience of death, or with sacred places and sacred vessels? Is that really what it's about? Jesus finally says, it's not what goes into a person, that is, what comes to you from outside. It's really what's going on within you that manifests itself. Jesus is saying the whole point of God's way of being in the world has to do with whether or not we trust Him, literally entrust ourselves to Him. You can keep the rules and violate the trust. He illustrates that with this crazy thing about korban. If you were obligated to care for your parents, that's what honoring your father and your mother was at least partly about. It was social security in Israel. But you could avoid that by declaring your gifts and property korban, that is, dedicated to God, which meant you could continue to use, have the use of, that which was dedicated to God, but you didn't have to use it for the care of your parents. Jesus says, you see, you know, you can do all of the external rules. You can have all this notion of the sacred and touching it, and keep the rules about relating to your parents and still break their intent, violate the whole intent of the enterprise. What is crucial is, in a sense, do we or do we not entrust ourselves to God's way of calling His people to be in the world? I think about this, you know, whenever I'm worried, as I frequently am, about the correctness of the liturgy. You can't be interested in liturgical scholarship without thinking of good manners in conduct of worship. And whenever I get caught up in good manners in worship, who does what when, and whether we stand or sit all together at the right place, whether we're kneeling when we're supposed to or not, it's good to remind ourselves that all of these things are really intended only to ritualize what is already the disposition of our own being, the trusting of God. That's the conflict with the Pharisees that Jesus is talking about. Now, after that come two healings. One of these is the woman, the Syrophoenician woman, and the other is the deaf person. The Syrophoenician woman was one of Luther's favorite stories because Jesus banters with this woman. She comes and he says, it's not right that the bread of the children should be thrown to the dogs. Well, the point is, you know, you're a Gentile, you're a dog. And she responds to it in kind. I imagine it for myself as if Jesus almost uses the word dog here in a satirical sense. You know what my people, the Hebrews, call your people. They're dog, you're dogs. It's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. And her response catches the spirit of this. Yes, Lord, but even the dogs get the crumbs. And Luther says, oh, what faith. Whatever God calls her, that, she says, is what I am, and enters into it. The two times when Jesus says, great is your faith, I have not found such faith in all of Israel, have to do both with Gentiles. See, one is this woman, and the other is that Roman centurion. And can you imagine again the shock, the shattering, you see? Here we are, the people of God. We are the ones who are really in tune with Yahweh. But the great faith that Jesus finds, like none other in Israel, happens to two Gentiles. The reign of God, the opening of God to the world, is not only for sinners, not only for the people we despise the most, but for ones who seem to be outside of the enterprise. All right, we're rushing through this, but let me now take up the feeding stories. Mark has two of them. There are seven accounts of these great feedings in the New Testament. And again, the curious thing that happens in Mark's gospel, both in the sixth and in the eighth chapter, is that the disciples miss the point. Let's look at Mark 6, 30, first of all. The apostles returned to Jesus, told him all that they had done and taught, and he said to them, come away by yourselves to a lonely place and rest a while, for many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. Sounds like the waitry. And they went to the boat in a boat to a lonely place by themselves. Now many saw them going and knew them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. Ooh. And he landed and saw a great throng, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to them and said, this is a lonely place, and the hour is late. Send them away to go into the country and villages round about and buy themselves something to eat. But he answered, you give them something to eat. And he said, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them? And he said to them, how many loaves have you? Go and see. And when they had found out, they said, five and two fish. And he commanded them all to sit down by companies upon the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds, by fifties. Sounds almost military. And taking the five, it was probably much more chaotic than that. And taking the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people and divided the two fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces and of the fish, and those who ate the loaves were about 5,000. What we are experiencing here, and the reason why this is such a significant story, it is the most repeated story in the gospel, seven times, as I said. The reason why this is so significant is because this was a messianic banquet. When the expectations of Messiah would be fulfilled, the form of those of that fulfillment would be that Messiah would feed everybody. people suddenly began to get the fever again. In John, it becomes very clear that they wanted now immediately to take him and make him king, not because he was going to be a one-man welfare department, but because this was really the sign that the kingdom was there. This was the thing that caught them. Now, Jesus does not, in one sense, negate this, and in another sense he does, because the true messianic banquet is going to be the one in which we are both fed and let in on Messiah's way of being in the world. It will be the eating of his body and his blood. And John interprets this, you see, with almost monomaniacal clarity. Jesus says, I am the bread from heaven. See, and if you're going to eat of my flesh and drink of my blood, and then you will be part of what I am up to in the world. So the real messianic banquet is still coming. And all of these feedings are signposts, pointers along the way. Now look at what happens. Here comes the walking on water story, and I brought along Jim Carroll's Elements of Hope just to read one of the ways in which he tells this story. It has to do with Peter. It's a dialogue. Isn't that him walking on the water? Oh, Peter, please, no more of your foolishness. What we need in times like these, times of crisis, are restraint, common sense. No, no, just look. There, don't you see the figure there where the waves crest? I swear it's him. Peter, stop and think. Water will support no one. Men sink. Besides, he's gone. We must live without visions, without him. But I tell you it is him. He's beckoning. Peter, we worry about you. You are not yourself. You are a practical man. We hate to say it, but you may need professional help. Stand back. I'm going over. Oh, we can't permit it. You'll drown. You're not responsible. Let go of me. It's him. He's calling me. Peter, we hate to use force. Quit struggling. The water won't hold you. It wouldn't hold him even if he were here, but he's gone. He would want you to be sensible. Think, Peter. Think. Give me my cloak. Oh, that's more of your foolishness. No one puts on a cloak before jumping into the water. Give it to me. He's waiting, I tell you. Well, can you swim? Oh, dear, he's gone. Swim, Peter, swim. Do you see that? Do you see that? Good old Peter walking on the water. Look, do you see? What do you think of that? I think Peter is magnificent in his backwardness. We might towel ourselves before bathing or say goodbye on meeting, but Peter, he wraps himself in death before leaping into life. Wow. Anyway, the point of telling this, you see, is that not again to say magic things are happening, but look at verse 52 of chapter 6. The disciples were utterly astounded. Jesus gets into the boat, the wind ceases, they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves. You see, of all things, again, Mark has done it. He has juxtaposed a story of the misunderstanding of the disciples with Jesus' dynamis, with Jesus' power, both in the loaves and in the water. Incidents. And now the same thing happens in 8, and that sets us up for the next big section of the gospel. Let's look at 8. In those days when again a great crowd had gathered, and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd, because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come a long way. And his disciples answered, how can we feed these men with bread here in the desert? And he asked them, how many loaves have you? And they said, 7. Again, I hope you notice both the similarities and the dissimilarities. What we are seeing is probably a single incident told in several ways. You see, you had five loaves and two fish in the earlier story, seven. Here you got seven loaves. And he commanded the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the seven loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they set them before the crowd. And now somebody remembers the fish and the retelling of the story. They had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he commanded that these also should be set before him. Before them, and they ate and were satisfied, and took up the broken pieces left over, seven baskets full, and there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away, and immediately got into the boat with his disciples, and went to the district of Dalmanutha. Again, you've got feedings and boats and loaves and numbers. It's probably the same set of stories, but Mark puts them both in. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them and, getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. And now comes the ominous conclusion that ends with verse 21. Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat, and he cautioned them, saying, "Take heed, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." They discussed it with one another, saying, "We have no bread." And being aware of it, Jesus said to them, "Why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened?" Same thing as in chapter 6. Remember, their hearts were hardened. They did not understand about the loaves, for their hearts were hardened. Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember, when I broke the loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full? And they said 12. And seven for the 4,000, how many baskets? And they said seven. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" Now the point of this is that we have had rejection by the Pharisees and the Herodians at the end of the first section, rejection by his townsfolk at the end of the second section, and now misunderstanding by those closest of all, the disciples. See, first of all, the leaders of the nation, then his own townspeople, now the disciples miss the point. It's almost like the closer you get, you see, the more likely there is to be misunderstanding instead of understanding. And we are poised now for the great central section where Mark has Jesus teaching the disciples, and He just brings us to the edge of this with the misunderstanding of the disciples, because now he's going to take two healings of blind people and bracket this central section in which Jesus will teach the disciples. They'll misunderstand about the way he is to be Messiah and they are to be the messianic people in the world. We haven't covered all of the details in here. I know this can be unsatisfying because there's lots of stuff here, but I'm trying to rush through it as we are so that we see the message also in the structure of the gospel and not only in the individual verses. Since the bell hasn't rung, though, we can either stand and stretch or we can talk just a little bit. What are some of your comments to all of this now? Many of you have been in on this for 3 or 4 days. Takes us a while to get going.
This feeding could have happened 2 different times.
It could have, yes. I think it may just have been one single incident, but you see, such a central one, such a decisive one, that it was told and retold many times and in many ways. And the details are close enough so that they could have been a single incident just told in different communities of the Christian church, or they could have been also different incidents. Now, Mark reports it twice and clearly doesn't report it as the same incident. But what he does with it is identical. There are boats and misunderstandings by the disciples in both of these. I don't want to make a big point of that. I've handled them together. It could have been two incidents. It seems to me more likely to have been a single incident which gets told like seven times in the Gospels. Yes, please, Chief.
Well, I can't find out in the story about the Syrophoenician woman, where does it say about Jesus and remarking on her face?
Oh, it doesn't in Mark. That's in the parallel story. In Matthew 15, 21 to 28, if you look there, it's the same incident. Verse 28, then Jesus answers, O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire. And her daughter is healed instantly. And then, I'm sorry, that was just a conflation of the incidents. Okay, thank you.